I'll never forget the first moment when I walked in Curious Cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Hello and welcome to the 18 Skyline Podcast of 2018 for your weekly update on Irish international film. I'm Darren Mooney, and joining me are
Alex
and Graham.
And we're going to talk about everything that's sort of relevant, as I'll take a look at the top 10 and new releases this week in Irish cinemas. But let's start with what we normally do, which is what we've watched this week. So, Alex, what have you watched since last we talked?
I've watched two films, both by Luc Besson, the French filmmaker, and both from different periods in his life.
So both a good and a bad choice.
Well, yeah.
And depends on who you ask.
That's the exact... And in many ways, they're both kind of representative of Besson's sort of spotty career of, like, getting one and then maybe completely missing one. Chronologically, I watched The Big Blue, which came out in like late 1980s, I think, originally, or early 1990s. But it was a film that's always been on my sort of, I wanted to see this for ages, because as a teenager, I quite liked a lot of the Luc Besson films, like The Professional and Nikita Lisa and The Fifth Element, which was like an early childhood one. I was like, this is incredible. But I'd always heard about this sort of like cult film he directed called The Big Blue, and I really didn't know much about it. So got it on Blu-ray and watched it. And it's incredibly beautiful. It follows two divers, and hence The Big Blue is the actual ocean, who compete in these deep diving competitions that I understand are no longer really run anymore because they're so dangerous. So it's based on two real-life characters, but Luc Besson decided to sort of take a bit of a friendship these two divers had and a bit of a professional sort of rivalry and really extrapolate it into this much bigger story. So these two divers are in real life were very different in age and kind of met through competitions and other things. But he starts like right when they're both children on the same Greek island. Like he really
rivalry.
He really throws out any sort of factual basis and just goes, you know what, I've got a story.
Divers, rivals, sold.
And it's incredible. So Jean Reno plays one, and another French actor who I didn't actually know.
That Jean Reno, doesn't he?
Yeah, he typical Jean Reno as well. He's very funny in this film. He's sort of more the comic foil. He plays the sort of Italian rival, and then the French guy is played by Jean-Marc Barr, who I didn't really actually know that much.
Yeah, I don't know the name.
Not as successful as Jean Reno in later life. But it's incredible. It's a very strange, very weird film in many ways. It sort of also follows Patricia Arquette, who is an insurance investigator.
Oh, so it's in English, is it?
No. So parts of it are in English, parts of it are in Italian, parts of it are in French.
Oh, okay. There's
lots of subtitles going on. And Patricia Arquette then plays like an insurance agent who sort of falls in love with one of them in the course of investigating kind of how dangerous this actually is. And it follows her, like, for a while she's nearly the protagonist, and then it sort of swaps over to one of the divers, and even though Jean Reno's character is sort of nearly set up as a villain sometimes, you can't help but like him, and then it sort of, you follow him for a while as well. It's a really long film, though, as well. And if you're, you know, looking to sort of be taken away to this whole, like, weird land of people competing to see who can dive the furthest, the strangest thing for me is the way people sort of say, onto the world championships, and I'd be like, are there world champions in like peak scenes? How far you can actually dive down? And apparently there are.
Yeah.
These two guys were the. I was looking into it. It was a major hit in France and wasn't as big a hit elsewhere. Americans actually got an edit of it, which sort of toned down a lot of the more grimmer aspects of the film.
Unsurprisingly,
changed the ending, shall we say, into
a big baby blue.
Yeah. But it's really good and. Jacques Chirac, I think, when one of the divers died recently, or years ago, he said that he was an enduring symbol of the Big Blue generation. And I remember always thinking, like, there's a Big Blue generation? This has completely gone over my head. But yeah, I'd really recommend it. It's got all those sort of, like, visual flourishes that Luc Besson's good at. It's got a really funny cast. It's a bit all over the place in story, but you learn to just sort of go with it and enjoy the visuals and the story and everything else. So, yeah.
It's a bit of a deep dive in terms of Besson fans.
Oh, God.
Definitely. A deeper dive then was the other Luc Besson film I watched, which is called Valerian and the City of a Thousand Planets.
I've wanted to watch this, but I've never brought myself
cities.
To.
Sorry.
Now the city
it's the
City of a Thousand Planets.
City of a Thousand Planets. Yeah.
Wow, that's even more grand.
Yeah. And this is what I wanted to watch as well, because as soon as I heard about this film, I was on board. I was thinking, this is incredible. And in, you know, with cinema sort of increasingly, like, we've got a Star Wars spin-off coming at the end of the month, but I was looking at this thinking, like, a relatively original sci-fi film with a big budget and an interesting director, this could be really, really good. And as I said, I was really into Luc Besson. And it really doesn't work. And I think what's sort of most frustrating is it comes so close to being the film you want it to be. So there's an incredible part at the start where it explains, and it plays this great David Bowie song, and it sort of explains the City of a Thousand Planets that started as a space station orbiting Earth, and then as alien life was discovered over millennia, people just started sort of using that as a port, and then gradually it almost got so big they had to move it out.
Sounds fantastic.
And there's so many really rich, interesting ideas in it. It's based on a French comic book, so we probably have to credit all that. Mm. And the interesting thing is the guy who did the original comic book actually was involved in... He actually had to have a lot of his stuff licensed for The Fifth Element. Ah. So that beautiful curved taxi that people probably know in The Fifth Element, that's his. And if you look at like the Valerian comics, they're actually in those...
Sort of pattern design.
And apparently at the time, the author sort of said, why are you paying to like license some of these ideas? Why not just make Valerian? And Luc Besson said, well, the effects aren't really where I want them to be. I will make Valerian eventually. But personally, I knew this was going to go off the rails when I was in France when this film was coming out and noticed that the posters everywhere, they had the two leads, Valerian, who's played by Dane DeHaan, who's doing a really like intense voice all the time, and Cara Delevingne, who is actually surprisingly good in the film. It's actually Dane DeHaan who probably deserves most criticism. And she gets off because you're like so appalled by his performance. But
his DeHaan-y work.
Oof.
But oh my God.
In these particular posters, they had Dane DeHaan and Cara Delevingne. And then behind them, you had Luc Besson turning archly over his shoulder and just like looking.
What?
And I remember thinking, only in France, you know, where the opera is revered and everything. But also thinking, that's got signs of like this guy's gone, maybe gotten a lift.
The ego is
the ego
with the size of the.
I don't think we ever saw any of those posters.
I would love to see. I'd love to see the solo poster with Ron Howard.
Yeah, archly looking over his shoulder.
Maybe
like, another
tip
one
in the
me.
Cap. Yeah, maybe tip in the cap too.
So it's a sort of it's a mess of different half-formed ideas. Every now and again, it hits on something, and you think that's so clever and that's so such an interesting idea, and particularly with sci-fi. Seeing something new, you actually are quite impressed, and like, wow. And it definitely has a lot of that. It just is so undermined by its... I think it's the script, I've decided, is the problem.
Clive Owen's in it, isn't he?
He is. Clive Owen plays their, like, chief. And, you know, this is a film where you're following a character and then Ethan Hawke shows up as a space pimp.
Yeah, with
and
Rihanna.
What? Rihanna is his charge. And you're like, oh,
why?
Just go with this.
That's real?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So it's full of those kind of moments that you're like, this could be so fun and good and great, and it just doesn't work. And I think it's because of the script. The characters talk in bullet points. They literally sort of, here are the three things we need to say. And there's even a point at the start where you're establishing Valerian and Laureline, who's played by Cara Delevingne, and their whole sort of interaction. And he literally says something like, I'm a space bad boy and you're a goody two shoes. And I remember thinking, like, whoa,
treatment summary of these two characters.
Yeah. And there's no time to write the dialogue to establish that. We'll just have him say it.
How long is that?
It's a long film, but
not long enough.
Not long enough or too long. I'm not going
to
completely slate it. I would recommend seeing it as this sort of very strange weird film.
And it is on Netflix.
Yes, and it is on Netflix. The script is appalling, so. Just go if you go into it like knowing that it's what you're getting into.
Turn the sound off.
Yeah, maybe or some. No, I didn't even know this. Make it worse. But it's you want it to be better, and I think that's what kills it for me. That it's close to being good. You just almost think, can you go back and remake some of this? Because I would like to see more Luc Besson sci-fi. But anyway,
but you can pick up the actual one of the albums of Valerian on Comixology at the moment.
Yes.
For free, if anybody wants to check that out. But yeah, a lot of where Besson's ideas came from, and a lot of where I think Lucas's Star Wars ideas came from as well.
Mm.
I think that was one of the issues in getting it made, was that Star Wars had already covered it on the ground, or at least that was the argument, I think.
Yeah.
The most expensive independent movie ever made, I believe, replacing Cloud Atlas in that distinction.
And sort of, would I have similar feelings about it, like, to Cloud Atlas, of being like, wow, this is close to me.
So close, but so far
in other ways,
So, Graham, what did you watch this week? Or in the time
since the last time I was in it? Well, it's been a little while, and I've seen several films. I recently saw Tully. with Charlize Theron. I also saw The Leisure Seeker.
Which one's The Leisure Seeker?
The one with Donald Sutherland.
Oh, it's the one with Helen Mirren.
They're on a road trip.
Yes, they are on a road trip. They are in The Leisure Seeker, as they say, as they call it. I call it The Leisure. And I quite enjoyed both of those films, actually. I really enjoyed them. And it's really all down to the performances. Charlize Theron, once again, is wonderful. She throws herself into this role like she seems to throw herself into every role she's in.
It does have a bit of body transformation.
Again,
so
it has body transformation.
Obviously.
And she simulated it, apparently, by eating copious amounts of pizza and whatnot to get her body...
Yeah.
In the afterglow of pregnancy. and it's a film that holds no bars into what happens during pregnancy to a family, to a relationship, and to a mother. And she sells it. Like, she really does. She's absolutely fantastic. And Mackenzie Davis is brilliant as well as Tully herself. She plays the titular character, Tully.
The nanny, the living nanny who comes to help the family out.
The night nanny, as
the
they
night
call
nanny,
her.
As they call
I
her.
Call her night ninja nanny.
I was surprised at how light this was. Like, I was surprised. Mm. I was kind of dreading it because I heard it was Diablo Cody doing the horrors of motherhood. Mm. And I was like, well, the last time she worked with Charlize Theron, we ended up with Young Adult, which is about the horrors of, like, not being an emotionally mature human being. So I was kind of dreading that, but I was surprised at how almost life-affirming Tully is in place.
I really like this. I mean, there is a third act
element
choice that is made that I think will turn away people. That could turn away people. It didn't turn me away. I
thought it was signposted well enough that it worked.
And then when I saw The Leisure Seeker, I went in not excited for this. I didn't think it was going to be good. I thought it was going to be one of those, oh, we're old, but we can do what the kids can do.
Las Vegas sort of thing.
Yeah, Las Vegas. Oh, God, I hate those
going
films.
Going in style.
Or every Morgan Freeman film that he's been doing for the past decade.
Yeah.
You know? He's like cornered that market of old people doing young people things.
Genre. Bucket list sort of stuff.
Yes.
Like, yeah.
But this
not making those films is on his bucket list.
This was not that. I found The Leisure Seeker was just about these two people having what could be one last adventure together. And it's a wonderful journey. Donald Sutherland is brilliant as a man who's losing all his faculties.
Oh,
he was once an incredibly witty, intelligent, charming individual, and that is slowly decaying. And then Helen Mirren's character sadly has got cancer, and it's just about the both of them just kind of losing themselves, but then also through traveling on the Leisure Seeker trying to find themselves again. Mm-hmm. And maybe because of how his mind is losing itself and how her body is failing her, trying to find each other along that way. And I really liked it for that. And then I saw Infinity War. Saw Solo.
We may talk about Infinity War at some point later in the podcast.
Yes.
It might possibly come up in our talk.
Alex, have you seen it?
I have. I haven't seen Solo yet. I'll probably go this next weekend.
Cool. So I watched a bunch of stuff. In keeping with the themes of the evening, I watched a film from a science fiction director of whom I am very fond, but who has maybe not had the most consistent track record of late. I watched Andrew Nichols' Anon. Which opened simultaneously on Sky Cinema and obviously in cinemas, which is interesting because that's very much like the what we want Netflix to do sort of argument.
The on-demand type thing they're trying to...
Yeah, and then very much, but it is the ideal of what people want from Netflix, which is like, I want the Martin Scorsese film in my sitting room, but I also somehow want to be able to go and see it in a gigantic cinema the way that it was meant to be seen in that sort of way. Which is not a practical way of doing business, and I think that Sky have tried this a couple of times. They tried it with Hurricane Heist recently, which I still have not been able to bring myself to watch.
I've heard okay things.
Really?
Yeah.
It's a great elevator pitch movie, like that kind of high concept, two words.
Also, I like Tony Campbell.
Yeah,
Campbell's always good.
Yeah.
It's Twister meets Heat, which is fantastic. Now
it's a hot mess.
But I mean, there is... So Anon is interesting because obviously it's Nichol. And Nichol is a fascinating science fiction writer and director. He's written three films I love, but two films that would be like in my top 25 films. So Time Project.
Could you just name them?
Truman Show and Gattaca, and he also wrote Lord of War, which I'm partial to. I know
I like Lord of War.
Yeah. And then he's obviously written a lot of less great stuff, like for example, that movie where time is money.
In Time.
The Justin Timberlake film?
Justin Timberlake and Amanda Seyfried, who pops back for a non. He wrote Good Kill, which he reteamed with Ethan Hawke from Gattaca. In which is a science fiction film that's happening right now. Mm. He also wrote Simone, which I think we may have talked about.
Yeah, which was one of these films that came out right at the wrong time. I feel if Simone had come out in the 1970s, people might have been like, wow, it's so prescient. And like, it's about a sort of digital actress. Al Pacino is a producer, and he kind of
invents
the digital actress and starts thinking and realizing then that he can't really control the media narrative around the actress.
Oh, like, I have heard of Simone.
It just slightly, you know, came out and was
who
making
is
all
Simone
these big points. I think she's a South African actress. Ironically, she was an actress who never went to much else. But in the film, it's like she's being awarded Oscars and everything. Yeah.
She can't work digitally. She can't work at all.
Yeah. But yeah, so Anon is sort of Andrew Niccol playing, and it's really disappointing because it's very clearly trying to be Gattaca, in much the same way that you sort of it suggested Valerian is sort of hinting at being the film. So
Clive Owen's in that one as well.
Yeah, so Clive Owen's sort
poor
of
Clive Owen.
Yeah, the market
poor Clive Owen.
On late stage films from directors capable of much better things. But he so Anon is basically it's a future without privacy where, you know, cops investigate crimes and everybody leaves a digital footprint that can be easily traced and everybody's information is readily available to them and you have these implants that allow you to see what the person ate last, their social media profile, access to where they've been and all this sort of stuff. And it's all very like, ooh, Facebook. Except it's, ooh, Facebook, you know, on steroids but with no real introspection.
That's really sad because How I Met Your Mother did an episode like that, like, I think like 7 years ago.
Yeah.
Where they fast-forwarded so that people had like glasses or contacts that could see all the information just by looking at a person's face.
Yeah, so Anon is that and it's a film noir but it's also a really bad film noir. It's like, because Gattaca works because it's a science fiction film noir, but it's a relatively good science fiction film noir because it's got a really well-defined characters, it's got really, like, heavy sort of labored dialogue, but dialogue that really works in the context of a film noir. It's sort of cheesy and self-aware, whereas Anon features dialogue like two characters lying in bed together when the hacker turns to the police detective and says, "Delete fucking everything." To which the police detective responds, "Especially the fucking." And you're like, you are better than this, Andrew Niccol.
God.
And also, like, there's a moment, like, during a briefing where they discover that somebody has managed to get their way out of this system. And the police detective declares, "Anonymity. That's the enemy. We have to find out how she does it and de-anonymize her."
Oh, that's a terrible word.
And you're like, no, this is just awful. Or, oh, I see. Taking a life, that's not important. Her not having a life, that is important. And you're like, thank you, Clive Owen, for stating the theme of the film. But then we cut to his Sierra Superior officer responding with, "Exactly." And it's like, no, you are so much better than this. The mystery is clumsy, the performances are awkward. And Niccol does this thing which is a little ambitious, and I kind of admire it formally, where he constantly changes the aspect ratio as he jumps between vantage points. So you're occasionally seeing what the character sees and you're occasionally seeing an objective viewpoint, and the aspect ratio changes as you do that. So you know that, for example, when people's, you know, eyesight or feeds are being manipulated, that what you're seeing is not necessarily representative of what is. So it's a nice device to let you know that, but it's also really jarring and distracting when you've got an action sequence that is cutting between three different aspect ratios with huge amounts of heads-up display text.
I see he learned from the school of Michael Bay directing there.
Yeah, well, I mean, it makes you appreciate what Nolan did with IMAX when he manages to integrate IMAX footage into a standard aspect ratio where it doesn't feel as intrusive. Whereas this is like...
He did that with The Dark Knight Rises, didn't he?
He did that with The Dark Knight, The Dark Knight Rises, Interstellar, and Dunkirk.
I'm not a fan of that particular cutting. I know we're getting kind of nerdy here, but the cutting between aspect ratios always takes me out of it.
It does. It jars, and it's particularly distracting in the concept of action scene where it's like beat, beat, beat.
Yeah.
Where it's like, I want to know where the characters are, so I need to process the information quickly as it comes into me. And like,
oh, did something change?
Yeah, something changed. I haven't realized what it is. Wait, something changed back.
Yeah.
I saw a Korean film there a year or two ago, and its aspect ratio, I don't know if I'm getting the technical terms wrong, but it would have it that the screen was just a circle.
Yeah.
So you were watching... You were watching the characters through a circle.
Nice.
And it was... I can't remember for the life of the film, but it was absolutely brilliant. And then when the character went to the mainland, the camera, the shots then went to a square, but it still didn't fully fill the screen.
The only time I really liked it,
and I liked that.
Yeah, it was in, I think it was Tron Legacy, and they did like
world.
The Wizard of Oz thing,
yeah.
Like, boom, and then the thing disappears, and you're like, whoa, right? Yeah.
I actually quite like the Grand Budapest Hotel does that quite
well.
Yeah, just between
different time zones. That's
so,
a good way of doing it.
Yeah, so it gives you a bracket within a bracket within a bracket. This is not the Grand Budapest Hotel, unfortunately. Mm-hmm.
Or Tron Legacy.
Yeah, I saw.
A series have gone on. People have really come to love that film.
I like Tron Legacy.
Another 10 years, we might get another sequel. Yeah,
yeah. With a properly utilized.
It's a Disney princess movie. Just happens to have a prince. Actually, yeah. That's what I really appreciate about it. But it's Anon is not probably going to get that assessment. I watched it for free, and it still cost me far too much.
Anon is a no.
Anon is a no.
Yeah.
And over the weekend then I watched Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, which is one of those movies I'm not sure whether or not I've actually seen it before or whether I just processed so many references.
I just know the joke from The Simpsons.
Yeah, it's
oh, no.
It's an ode to democracy, written, directed, and filmed in 1939, released obviously on the edge of the Second World War.
Yeah.
But it's an ode to this idea of the United States democracy and what makes it special. And it's become like this weird civics lesson sort of since then. It's like how government is supposed to work for people. And I'm watching it, and I feel a little cynical because now I'm
just a little cynical.
I'm looking at the world as it exists, and this is like ground zero for the trope of the unqualified politician. This is the root cause of like movies like Dave,
people who think they can just have a go.
Yeah, that's it exactly. Like Dave, where the president has a heart attack and he's replaced by a school teacher who looks like Kevin Kline, who does a much better job, for example.
Or the Designated Survivor.
Yeah,
which has sadly been cancelled.
Which is simply, what's it called, The Distinguished Gentleman with Eddie Murphy.
Head of State with Chris Rock.
Yeah, there's
the Robin Williams film. What was that one where he becomes like?
Oh,
do you remember
he was
a TV personality?
He was like a Stephen Colbert type.
Yeah.
He joked about running. And
then Man of the Year.
Yes. I actually liked that.
I liked it, but I preferred if they like focused on the campaign. It felt like the whole thing was over so quickly, and now it was him looking lost in cabinet meetings. It wasn't as fun.
Which might actually, if you think about it, might have foretold the future.
Yeah.
that's the thing. I'm watching Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and like it has been this sort of like triumphant ode of the common man's need to cut through the red tape of Washington. And I'm watching that thinking, is that the reason that we're in this mess that we're in right now?
Capra is to blame.
Yeah. Is this the movie that people are thinking of when they say the British public have had enough of experts?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's like, it
personally, I doubt Trump has ever seen Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Yeah,
that is a fair point.
Or A Wonderful Life.
Or he has, and he thought Pottersville looks fantastic.
Yeah,
that's the dream.
Great
right there.
Real estate there.
Yeah. And then finally, one more, I finally watched Into the Wild over the weekend.
I haven't watched that yet.
It combined to three things that I hate, which is Sean Penn, Emile Hirsch, and
Christopher
McCandless.
Oh, wait, no, sorry. I mixed it up with Search for the Wilder People. Never mind.
Search for the Wilder People's fantastic.
Wilder People, never mind. Yeah.
That's
what are we talking about? That's the one where, like,
he decides to abandon his family and travel America.
Yeah, and doesn't he like? Yeah, I won't spoil it. Yeah,
it spoils itself pretty early on.
Think, yeah.
And everybody knows the ending because it happened in 1992. But it's basically Christopher McCandless, this guy who disappeared into the wilderness to find himself and to find some deeper meaning for it all, and did not survive the experience. And I find myself. I'm not normally you have to be faithful to reality or, ooh, this story's exploitational. But I always find the attitude towards McCandless a little bit exploitational, where it's like this kid who died, who wandered into the wilderness, who died because he didn't know the right stuff to eat, becomes like a martyr or a symbol for, you know, what we want to project onto him, which is this idea that maybe modern society is too disconnected and we need to get back to our roots.
Yeah.
And again, it's maybe this is, I feel, maybe I'm being really elitist because I remember reading about Alaska, where Christopher McCandless went and where Christopher McCandless dies. Alaska absolutely hates him.
Yeah.
Wow, really?
Because what happens is once every year there are about a dozen, between a dozen and two dozen people who go hiking to recreate his experience, despite not being qualified and having no experience and not...
So they die?
No, they get stranded.
And the true experience is not knowing which berries you can or cannot eat.
Yeah. But they get lost and they get stranded, and so the search and rescue has to recover them at the expense of the taxpayer. And it all seems, you know, to the Alaskans who are like, well, look, we are aware of how dangerous the environment is, and we're only here because we have to, like, we only bring them because we have to eat, because we have to, like, we have to, you know, get the minerals in order to, like, pay our salary and our wages to keep our family fed. These guys touring up here and going wandering because they want to find enlightenment is a little bit condescending to us. And I kind of...
There's a lot... I remember there's another scene in the film where he goes and applies for a whitewater kayaking license. Or rather, he goes to sort of ask about kayaking down a particular river and gets told, oh no, you need a license to do that. And he sort of is like, screw you, man, and, you know, hops in his kayak and proceeds to go down the thing. And I remember thinking, though, like, there's rescue people who now, you know, if you upturn, will have to, like, risk their lives to get you out of that river.
And the film, like, the film, Sean Penn, like, portrays this as some sort of triumph of the human spirit. Like, look at this jackass, he's having a great time.
We don't need licenses to drive cars, we just do it.
Who are you to tell me what I can't
do? This is really life affirmation gone wrong.
Yeah, it is. Jesus. It's not great. I'm not a huge fan of it, as you may have deduced. But
what got me is he never called his mother. I think he would have been totally redeemed in my life. You just call your mother every now and again and be like, I'm fine, I'm living, I'm homeless in Arizona, but I'm fine.
Don't worry about me.
No, do you know why? Because the mom would have found him.
But to be fair, you know that the opening scene where the mother hears him calling out as he dies?
Yeah.
That's based on her account of events. She claims to have heard that connection. And it's really sad because the film portrays him going away as like bringing the family closer together, which is another one of the weird, like, he's basically Jesus stuff. It's like, think of what he sacrificed by leaving his family so they could learn to love one another, when in reality the family basically tore themselves apart trying to capitalize on his legacy. Like, his sister and his parents both published different biographies of him offering competing visions and using different photographs that they were able to sort of pull from his
each other's arms,
presumably. It's really sad, and like watching the film try and present it as like a joyous, uplifting fable is, it's very disconcerting. Anyway, so let's talk about the week in film, Irish and international. The big news this week is that there's a collaboration launched between the Irish Film Board and British Columbia Creatives, which with each partner contributing $75,000 towards a total of $150,000, because we can do basic maths here, in order to develop motion picture projects between Ireland and Canada. This is working off the back of the success of a pilot scheme which ran last year, which led to a new adventure series, The Gulliver Curse, which I believe is currently in production. But it's kind of good to see that going on there. They're accepting applications at the moment, so if you have a project that's, you know, could potentially capitalize on an Irish and Canadian connection, you can apply directly to the Irish Film Board or to British Columbia Film. The projects must be scripted fiction. They must have an Irish resident producer and a British Columbia resident producer. And at least 50% of the fund will be dedicated to projects with a female writer or director attached to the project. So there's a big, strong gender parity push there, which is very, very good to see.
As an Irish and Canadian citizen, I am offering my producing services in case anyone wants to do a quick tax cheat.
I could serve on both these services. We have one producer who happens to fill both of these diversity boxes. I like
just
this.
Give me a day to get over to British Columbia and set up.
You're like Dan. You're like the sort of what's his name, Johnny Depp in The Lone Ranger. Basically, we like that. We should see more of that with Canadians, I think. Canadian appropriation. The Galway Film Fla, which is getting ready to run, it'll be running on the 10th through the 15th of July.
Good gosh, it's already that time of year.
It's already that. Well, I mean, it is sunny outside. I mean,
just about.
Well, I mean, it'll be running then basically in July, but they have they're accepting entries for their pitching competition, which is always hugely popular.
This will be the first year for the Palace, won't it?
It will be, which is great. Nice. The Palace is apparently amazing. From what I'm hearing from people who've been there, it's fantastic. Despite there are apparently occasionally zoning arguments over it, but still. But hey, these things tend to be a little bit contentious. But apparently, the film going into there loves it. It's they had, I believe, a dog friendly screening of Isle of Dogs as well.
So they stole from the lighthouse.
Well, no, they are the lighthouse.
They
are the lighthouse. Like, that's how it works better if you imagine them saying that in the style of Sylvester Stallone. I am the lighthouse. But the Galway Fla pitching competition is basically. It's designed to allow people who have story ideas to get them sort of started, to give them an audience pitch to, and also give them a potential cash reward. The idea is that you open up you enter a 500-word pitch of your entire movie from beginning to end, and you send it in, you submit it, there's a 30 euro fee, and if it does well, It'll be shortlisted for the finals, in which you will be asked to deliver an elevator pitch of 90 seconds in front of an audience and a panel of industry judges on the closing day of the film file, which is the 15th. The winner will receive...
Cash prize
of €3,000.
Okay.
And it's primarily also a way to get your name out there as well. So, for example, Will Collins, who pitched originally the idea that was My Brothers... and he also wrote Song of the Sea, so he got his start there as well. So there is a kind of a there's a long history there.
Yeah, it's a nice legacy.
It's a nice thing to have under your belt. So if you are considering entering, you can do that via the film flaw. A long similar sort of note in terms of competitions. Nyssa Hardiman's Sea Fever won the award at the Frontiers platform at the Marché du Film at Cannes, which is very good to see. It's good to see that sort of success happening over there. I mean, we've talked a little bit about Irish films doing quite well.
Yeah.
There are a lot of Irish films at the Marché de Cannes at the moment, which is very, very good. There's another one there. I'll just try and drag the name out of it in a second. It is Morgan Bush's The Belly of the Whale is also on sale from XYZ Films. But yeah, it's great to see sort of Nyssa Hardiman's Sea Fever enjoying a bit of success there. It hasn't been made yet. It will start shooting in August. It's about a marine biology student who finds herself isolated from her superstitious trawler crew as they struggle to overcome a deadly parasite in their water supply. Toni Collette is already attached to Star, which is really, really good. It sounds like it could be a nice genre piece. I'm very, very excited about this.
Sounds great.
Oh, cool. Is there anything else actually in terms of Cannes this week? Has anything happened since last we spoke?
I'm trying to think. I mean, the usual stuff is all the Lars von Trier.
the panic and the average. Well, there was the March of the Women, the 82
yes.
women, to symbolise the 82 films in contrast to, was it, the 1,400 male films that have been sort of screened at Cannes. Only 82 with a female director in the entire history.
Oh, well, really?
Of the festival, yeah.
Wow.
Solo
had its premiere at Cannes?
It did indeed, and it seemed to do reasonably well. A lot of people were surprised that it turned out relatively competent.
Those people clap anything, though, don't they? Like, they clap when a film is terrible and they're delighted.
Well,
yeah.
I mean, the Cannes audience is notoriously...
I'd love to see the Cannes audiences.
The Cannes audiences are notorious. I don't know if this is just the critic screenings or if that's the premiere screenings as well, but the critic screenings are notoriously rowdy, where they will shout and cheer and boo at anything. Mm-hmm. There's a very strong... Apparently,
I would love to see a boo. I've never seen a boo in a film.
I always say this, that Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull premiered at Cannes and also got applause.
It did.
Yeah. People were singing the theme song like dun 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 dun. So I remember reading.
As Mutt was swinging through the vines with the monkeys.
Well,
I was reading early reports and being like, this is great news, guys.
Yeah, right here.
Claps at Cannes, so this should be fine.
And they're normally, you know, the French.
They don't go overboard.
Well, I mean, that's the thing with Cannes, because I remember there being a lot of sort of discussion about this when it was announced the Solo would premiere there. But Cannes really, really loves its big stars and really, really loves the celebrities. So, like, for example, Mad Max would have premiered there.
Yeah.
And obviously Inside Out, I think, opened the festival one year as well. So they do like their big Hollywood films.
Yeah.
And,
that is as big a Hollywood film as going into. Yeah. I haven't seen it yet, but I imagine it's,
takes
all those boxes.
And it's...
It does.
It's strange to sort of, And the reaction is always, again, this is the era of hype where we live in, where the initial reaction on social media
becomes a new story on itself.
Yeah,
you almost have to deduct a good 20% from that to get a sense of where it's going to land.
Yeah.
And I mean, even...
You could definitely do that with this.
But
I think expectations are quite low on this one.
Yeah.
But was the story that no one...
Would you go so far as to say they're so low?
Hey.
Oh. That's three puns. Three puns this episode alone, okay? I'm watching you. Five and you get a red card.
So yeah, I think, you know, I remember going into Rogue One, whatever it was, 2 years ago. And,
yeah, 2 years ago.
But it was, Rogue One looked good. And I felt at the time, everyone was kind of so off the back of The Force Awakens, being like, another one of these? Great.
Star Wars, untouchable.
Yeah, Rogue One was a little icky. I liked it, but it certainly wasn't as good as The Force Awakens. And whereas I think the opposite here, people are going in being like, well, this is going to be terrible. And if it isn't terrible, people are like, whoa.
It's almost like Disney can't lose.
but it is. Like, given the production history, 70% of it reshot.
Yeah.
Which is...
I heard 80.
Okay. I see your 80 and raised
you 90.
But, there is. And even, like, when you compare that to, say, Justice League or Suicide Squad, which you presume was in the same boat... It's like the fact that this is a functional narrative film.
I will still always say that, you know, Suicide Squad, Oscar-winning film.
I know. That's something that winds up. Internet
none of those
fans.
New Star Wars films has got that. Yeah. It actually beat Force Awakens.
All right, with that in mind, then we will move on to talking about the top 10 in Irish films. So,
I have seen several of these.
You have seen several of these?
I may have seen several of these.
All right, so let's do the buzzer round. At number 10, it's Rampage.
Yeah, I saw that.
I have also seen it.
I have seen that for the trip tape. It is perfectly fine.
Yes, it is reasonable.
Yeah. You know exactly what you're getting with this film going in, and it meets
And I liked that gorilla. Yeah. I liked that gorilla. Best acting in the entire film.
And it also very earnestly delivers the line, "That's not the George we know." It's like,
I liked it because it was like a good video game movie. Too.
Yeah,
it is the best
video game.
That's why it works.
The key, much like Edge of Tomorrow, there isn't actually a video game, but this is a great video game.
At number 9, it's Entebbe, which we saw together.
It's good.
It's okay.
It's okay.
It's basically
all over the place.
It's got a lot of tonal issues. It's got a lot of narrative issues. It can't figure out where it's going to put its attention.
Daniel Brühl's great though.
This is one about the Ugandan hijacking.
Yes. And again, it's one of, like, I think when we talked about it, Jay was like, I've already seen a dozen movies like this.
Yeah.
And I remember
he probably has, because there's about a dozen of them.
Yeah. And I went back to Wikipedia, and it's like within a year of the hijacking, you had the gritty indie drama from New Hollywood about it. You had the crowd pleasing disaster movie blockbuster about it, starring Elizabeth Taylor. You also had the Israeli.
I was going to say there's some Israeli propaganda.
This isn't even the title they have in America. It's called 7 Days in Entebbe. Here it's called just Entebbe.
7 Days in Entebbe sounds like a sort of a like an action comedy.
It sounds like the Harrison Ford film with Anne Heche.
Oh, that's 7 Days and 7 Nights. Yeah,
it's the sequel.
Yeah, but yeah, 7 Days in Entebbe.
It was good. Daniel Brühl and Rosamund Pike, as usual,
are both solid.
They're both solid actors.
Yeah. I wouldn't go so far as to call the film brutal. Sorry, that was terrible.
One more.
At number 8, still hanging in there, Peter Rabbit.
Oh God!
Attaboy. I liked that film. I thought it was really fun.
I have not seen it.
I haven't seen it yet.
It's no Paddington 2.
Very few films are Paddington 2. I like the way Alex is like, that does not surprise me.
That's a high bar, though, Paddington 2. Yeah.
Yeah, Paddington 2 is fantastic.
Paddington 2 is fantastic.
Big, warm, comfort hug of a movie. At number 7, still in there, A Quiet Place, which is great.
Yeah.
Earned €1 million to date in Ireland alone.
That's great.
It's great to see like a
small... I need to understand that. Is that good?
Well, it is. Like, you got to keep in mind that, for example, okay, to go through the total grosses that we've seen so far, Rampage has only earned $500,000.
Okay.
So in its total run, Entebbe earned $9,000 last weekend, and that would pretty much be its total almost. Peter Rabbit has earned $3.2 million, but that's a family film that's been hanging around
since Easter.
So A Quiet Place earning $1.1 million is that's remarkable, great.
And the sequel is planned.
Peter Rabbit too.
No, well,
quiet
yes,
place. Another Quiet Place,
and another Quiet Place.
I hope they call it.
I was just going to say A Quieter Place.
Yeah, A Quieter Place. Or The Quietest Place.
The Quietest Place is the third one. It's like set in a monastery.
Too quiet, too place.
Yeah.
With Vin Diesel.
But yeah, and I really liked it. I've seen, I think everybody here has seen it, have we?
Yes.
Yeah.
Loved it. I really think he did a fantastic job, John Krasinski, that I didn't expect from him because I haven't seen any of his previous directorial films. I haven't seen him write before. I just know him as Jim
from The Office.
Yeah, from The Office. That's seriously all I knew him as. And then, like, this to me came out of nowhere.
Yeah, and I was the same. And I think it's such a basic idea, but it's quite clever.
Mm.
And it kind of, for me, took me back to that like early promise of M. Night Shyamalan. You know, that thing when you're like thinking like, this is great. This, you know, I'd watch a million of these.
And then
it reminded me of the early days of when Cloverfield first.
That's
what it did for me.
You had that sort of like low budget horror that was somehow still a blockbuster sort of vibe to it, which was really, really impressive.
But you didn't really know much going in, and then you were consistently surprised at the way it took a relatively simple formula, like a monster attacking New York or aliens and all these things, but does something interesting with it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a lot of, now that you mention it, so it's hard not to see bits of Signs in it, for example.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But a much quieter. It's a much
and
subtler.
And no Mel Gibson, yeah. Which is always a plus.
And just to make something so fantastical, so personal,
yeah.
was
and I like Signs, actually, getting back to Signs.
Oh, no,
and that's exactly what you were saying there about like making this big disaster movie, making immediately personal to another family.
And living in a cornfield, an alien invasion where it's...
Now that I think about it, this Signs comparison actually...
And it's not just because there's a cornfield.
Not just because, not but just that may be a large part of it. At number six, it is Tully, which we already talked about, which we quite like.
I have not seen it yet, but I will be going to this.
You liked it. You were there.
I really liked it.
Yeah,
I wasn't there, but I liked
it. Oh, you've seen it?
I've seen it. I really, really liked it.
I really liked Young Adult. Well, liked is probably a wrong word. I, you know,
appreciate.
It's really hard to say those things for those type of films.
So I'm looking forward to Tully.
And I was actually quite... I was pleasantly surprised that it was as gentle as it was.
Gentle films from Universal. I was pleasantly surprised.
Speaking of gentle films from Universal, Breaking In is at number five.
Didn't see that. Okay, my first break from it.
I haven't seen that either.
No, I saw the trailer last night for the first time. I was like, oh right. So it, you know, the twist is she's trying to get into her house when you're eating the guy.
It's an impenetrable house.
It's like Panic Room, but the opposite or something.
Yeah, there's your elevator pitch. It's your hurricane house moment.
So it's Panic Room without the room. So it's just panic.
But again, the tagline sort of has me with Payback is a Mother. But also has like a really great TV movie cast as well.
Yeah.
Like, you know those actors who are like Gabrielle Union and Bad Billy Burke.
Like, Gabrielle Union as well, like, I remember seeing her in films in the 90s and she looks the exact same.
Yeah,
she has like a
painting. Yeah, she has not aged. Because I watched her in Friends season like 6 or something and she looks the same.
I went back and I rewatched Star Trek. She had an early role in Star Trek. She looked quite different, but that may be because she was under a lot of makeup. Deep Space Nine, she was in Soldiers of the Empire. She was a Klingon. She had all of 2 lines because she was not yet famous. They didn't bring her back the next year because then she got a starring role in Kolchak, the Night Stalker, I think she was in. Remember when Stuart Townsend was almost a thing?
Yeah. Queen of the Damned.
I remember that because all the girls of my year was like, oh my god, that film was like, it's so boring. It's just like everyone cares about shirts being ripped off. It's like, what's going on?
And the Interview with the Vampire is fun, you know.
I love Interview with the Vampire.
Queen of the Damned. So it's a different way.
It's like, and it's just really funny. It's like, is that whose character is that? And it's like, oh, it's Tom Cruise's character.
Oh,
weird.
Yeah, so.
But anyway, so at number four.
Let's see now. What else?
What?
What else? I'm just trying to think. What else could it be out?
Oh, do you want to guess what's the number 4?
No.
Come on, what have we listed so far?
Where's the leisure seeker?
R2.
I suspect you know 1 or 2.
Where's the leisure seeker? I mean, it's around
the
same time.
No, the leisure seeker's not in there.
Not in there yet.
So, number 4.
Go for
Life of the Party, starring Melissa McCarthy.
Oh,
yeah. Did anyone see that?
No, not yet. No. I heard it wasn't as good as some of her other ones, though. It's not.
I've heard it's okay. Yeah, so actually the same.
And I feel like we had a good run of studio comedies this year with Game Night and with Blockers.
That were good.
That I feel like eventually.
Well, we're going to have Tag.
That kind of looks funny. Whatever that. Yeah, that's good.
It also has
funny.
It also has that really good sort of central metaphor thing going on, where it's like, hey, there's an emotional reason for these men to act like children.
Yeah. Also, it explains where Hawkeye was.
Yeah.
Playing a great game of tag.
turns out Hawkeye is never it, which is an appropriate metaphor for his role in the Avengers. I do like that the life of the party, the plot synopsis, the official plot synopsis is plot details are being kept quiet. But earned 72,000 euro at the Irish box office to date. At number 3, I Feel Pretty, which is still doing great business.
I did not see that.
I think this is counter-programming, actually, which is really good to see, because there's an argument how, in the States, counter-programming has sort of increasingly become something that they steer away from, where, like, other studios now cower from the Disney movie-making extreme, as opposed to even, like, you go back to
the I thought it was a thing that they were trying to push towards it, because, you know, there are, like, obviously the last 2 spots are Disney films, so
I thought some films, like, something like
Star
Wars.
They're not...
One of them is, though.
One of them is,
yeah.
But, I mean, generally...
Next week it will be, too.
But, generally speaking, though, there's been, like, if you look at 2008 when The Dark Knight was released, you had romantic comedies coming out that same weekend, you had The X-Files movie coming out the same weekend, you had like a host of other alternatives for people who wanted to go and see movies that weren't the big movie of the week.
Yeah.
Whereas now, you're not really seeing that much anymore. Yeah.
And I think it's partly because of the success of those films where people can dip in and out of a Marvel film, for instance. You don't necessarily have to see all the rest to go and enjoy Black Panther. You get it, you can go. Yeah. Or Star Wars, where you're not going to necessarily run a comedy against one of the new Star Wars films. Because people who are into a comedy will probably go see that Star Wars film.
Yeah. Can I guess what number two is?
Go for it.
Is it Deadpool?
No, Deadpool's not out until next week.
It's out as we're recording.
It's out for 2 days. Yeah, the box office last weekend.
Never mind.
Curses. Like that, we have a show rolling
curses
money
is
counter.
The same, Darren.
I feel like it would actually be really cool.
I have ruined the timeline.
I'll just check the little like paper.
Yeah. Oh my.
What is it? A Victoria?
Oil is up by 10. But yeah, the little ticker tape that's constantly feeding us box office numbers. It would be fantastic. Do you want to have another go at what's number two? What haven't we mentioned so far?
I know.
The Greatest Showman, obviously. I mean, that's got to come
that
right back.
That cast is surging in there. No, I think we've got a whole 3 weeks without The Greatest Showman. It's really disconcerting.
Yeah.
It's like when one of those shops, one of your favorite shops shuts down that you've never been to in a little while, but you still feel a very strong affection towards.
No, I can't think of it.
Okay.
Because I know Infinity War is probably number one.
It is Sherlock Gnomes. Yeah, filling that
really?
Gap. Yeah.
The Johnny Depp film.
Yeah, do you want to guess how much it earned?
1,000.
I'm going to go the other way and say 1,000,000.
163,000 for a running
total. Ah, I went because you went
over. It's a running total of €293,000
still
to date.
That's a lot of money. Wow.
That is a lot of money.
For how long?
For just over 2 weeks, so it ended last week. Although it had previews, I think, technically speaking, last week.
It did, yes, it
did. A little sneaky. But yeah, I'm kind of hoping that the franchise, although I know it's terrible, I'm hoping the franchise goes long enough to get movies like Gnome on the Range, or, you know, Gnome Alone.
How long have you been
saying Gnome's Land? I may have used them already in last week's podcast. At number one, surprising absolutely nobody, Infinity War. Which I think this might be its last week on top, but if it is, it's had
because
a pretty good run. I suspect. Well,
Deadpool might take it for a week, but Infinity War might pull it back.
No, what's happening a week after Deadpool?
Oh, yeah.
Star Wars.
So I think it's...
They're starting to cannibalize each other.
Well, that's the argument, is that there are too many tentpoles at the moment. In fact, it's actually a bit of a surprise that, you know, Infinity War managed to get, like, as much space as it did, technically speaking. Because now it's tentpole after tentpole.
I think it's because it was one side of the tent, and then Solo was the other side of the tent, and everyone's like, there's not enough room in this tent!
Why not kick back Solo another month, and then have Infinity War reign supreme for another...
Because of the schedule of the... They wanted to get to the schedule of when it was supposed to be released, and even though, Ron was brought in... 2-3 weeks before the film was finished, they wanted to keep that schedule of May 25th because it is an important date, I believe, in Star Wars history.
All right, yeah. So what's the importance of May 25th?
It is the date of when audiences were introduced to Han Solo. It's when Episode One. That confused me now.
When A New Hope
came out. When Star Wars came out.
Yeah, but in terms of what we're talking about, like in terms of blockbuster crowding and having it planned ahead of time, you remember there was a mini fiasco where when Disney moved Infinity War back a week. Remember when Robert Downey Jr., because originally it was planned to do what Marvel movies do, which is they open in the rest of the world a week ahead because they coincide, our holidays tend to align a week ahead.
Yeah.
So with Infinity War, because the ending, spoiler, may be a big deal, they decided to move the US date back a week, and they announced it via obviously a cute little Twitter thing with Robert Downey Jr. But one of the cuter things that happened as a result of that was Amy Schumer like writing an Instagram post.
Was it Schumer?
Basically writing a little post and saying, well, I guess I'll just move my indie movie back a week as well then.
Did she?
Because, I Feel Pretty came out a week early because it had to come out in the States ahead of Infinity War.
Yeah,
Jesus.
And it was, I'm just doing it because I want to, not because you guys...
Steal your picture.
Yeah, not because you guys are going to crush us underfoot if we don't. But, like, that's how rigorous it is. And you're right that the dates are all set. Because if you think about it, if you go later in the year, there's pretty much a blockbuster every major week. There's, you know, we can rhyme them off the top of our head. There's Jurassic Park. Ark, the Lost Kingdom, or whatever, Fallen Kingdom. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, Incredibles 2 coming.
Mission
Impossible 6.
Looking forward to Mission Impossible.
Really, I'm really looking forward.
I have a theory, and okay. I know this is the thing, but like, the more I think about it, the whole mustache thing, and the way in Mission, for anyone who doesn't know, the idea
mustache
of mustache gate, yeah.
Trust me, I know all about it.
And Paramount not letting Henry Cavill shave his
goddamn where Paramount.
It's like a really great power play from a studio.
Oh,
that
is, but
it's
I have a feeling they're setting something up for the actual movie, because those Mission Impossible movies, not to give anything away, but often end with someone taking off a mask or something.
So you think that he takes the mask off and Superman?
No, I was thinking even better is he takes off the mustache. And the idea is you could set up that, like, oh, is he going to reveal, and he just takes off the mustache, and then they make fun of him as like, oh, that's your super spy disguise, and that's why they didn't want. Yeah,
and that would be hilarious.
It'd be so funny.
I just, all of Justice League ruined for a punchline. Well, I mean, there was the other suggestion that his set before the trailer aired that his second scene in the movie would involve him shaving the mustache,
yeah.
Just as like an ultimate sort of dominance.
That's the reason. Sort of God.
But yeah, but like Paramount have had enough trouble lately that you're kind of like, well,
these
guys deserve a win.
It's their only franchise.
Yeah, they deserve a win.
Hey, they'll have maybe
Bumblebee.
Oh yeah, Bumblebee is the other big one this summer.
Also, you know what?
It's this time. Hold on, let's check the date.
I've heard
also,
nothing about
don't Bumblebee. They have or is it Sony that has
Oh, it's this December.
Are they the
it's
ones that have the
Warner's Warner's have the die repeat, which is The Edge Tomorrow.
Ah.
But yeah, Bumblebee is due out this Christmas.
Also, they've got enough money from that stupid franchise that they have to apologise for things.
What?
The Transformers franchise.
Paramount don't have any money, that's the issue.
Well, boo-hoo.
Spend too much in Annihilation.
Yeah, and then shipped it directly to Netflix in international territories.
Seriously?
Yeah. And
that's the reason?
Not the reason.
It's a microcosm of the reason.
Well, okay, the reason is more like monster trucks, which
yeah.
is famously an idea that was developed by a Paramount executive's 8-year-old son. And somehow
the actor
came
Lucas
Hedges.
Yeah,
but like, again, that's a $100 million movie.
Also known as Young MacGyver, or modern-day MacGyver.
But yeah, let's move on then and take a look at the new releases that are coming out this week.
Oh, we didn't talk about Infinity War.
Anybody want to talk about Infinity War?
I still liked it. It's a truly, like, it's incredible the way they sort of managed to get this clown car film of everyone together, and it actually works.
So
you know, you're not like...
It's exactly what you said.
Yeah.
That seems to be a big takeaway from this. Like,
yeah.
It's like, it worked.
I think part of it is maybe that, and it's the way it works is because the villain is so good. And
yeah,
film, like,
I liked the villain.
But the film almost follows the villain as if he's the protagonist.
But that's
he's the
point.
Thing that, like, links, yeah.
But that's the point. And that's why the characters, I think, the cast don't work as well as they usually do, because they are technically the villains. They're stepping in.
That's...
Yeah.
I'm not entirely convinced by that, because...
But I think it's because you're so... You're enamored with the original Thanos, who this is not Thanos. Like, this isn't the original Thanos. And you've read the comics.
I'm a hardcore comic nerd.
And you love Thanos.
The guy who wants to sleep with death. Come on,
yeah.
Tell me. Like, not figuratively, not in like the poetic
no,
French
because
man
death
way.
Is a real thing
in like a, in like a very literal, absolutist sort
yeah.
of way. But the issue is that with this film, like, it's no spoiler to say that he wants to like control. He wants to prevent overpopulation in the universe. There's a magic globe that will allow him to do whatever he wants, and he plans to use that magic globe to kill half the people
it's
in the
so
universe.
It's so sad when people call it a glove.
But you're like, the only reason for him to kill half the people when he wears the glove is because the plot needs him to.
Mm.
It's like, why can't he just say twice as much food? Because
then the universe just gets bigger. He's looking for the end game.
The universe is going to keep getting bigger. I hate to be the guy who has to tell Thanos.
No,
you know when you kill half the people in the universe?
Yeah.
They're just going
to... Or you know what he did to, like, what he did to the Asgardians. It's like a quarter of them now.
I like the ending, and I hope that they explore a little bit more about... some of the where the ending leads on.
Yeah.
When I say the ending, I don't mean the sort of plot leading to the actual physical place where they leave the villain, shall
yeah.
we say.
Mm.
I think there's something going on there. If anyone's read, and this is getting really pretentious, there's a Jonathan Fraser novel called Freedom, and there's a character in it who quite literally kind of decides to... He's so worried about the population of animals in America, he decides to almost sort of become one of these like fracking drill guys to... execute a plan to try and like save these. It's really well done and really
yeah.
good, and in one of those things that again at a certain point you realize this guy's brilliant and totally with this guy.
That's an absolute point. Yeah. It makes a great deal of sense.
I just think that's...
Murder half the universe.
That's why I think it's funny just going... There's an argument to say he's technically not Thanos. He's an original character that they just gave the skin of Thanos
that's
to.
That's not an issue. It doesn't
matter.
No,
I'm not saying that.
Killmonger
just...
in Black Panther has nothing to do with the comic book character. He's still a fantastic character.
Mm.
It's more just the internal logic of the
character. When we first saw Thanos in Avengers, the line was stated, to challenge them is to court death. And he turned and he smiled and was just like, yes, it's Thanos. He is excited because there's a chance that if he could cause as much chaos as possible,
he was also
the Avengers.
Much purpler. Like, I mean, it's
actually,
not as if Thanos...
Actually, he was more red. Yes.
It wasn't like...
And then he had a slightly tinged purple phase in Guardians, and now he's purple.
I like that we described it as a tinged purple... Thanos went through a purple phase.
He went through a violet phase,
yeah.
He probably, as he got more powerful...
Got more purple.
Actually, it's the pressure.
That totally works. That totally works.
His blood pressure is just so...
He's got a lot of stress as he goes on.
Yeah.
And he doesn't look like he eats very healthily, if we're being entirely honest.
Are you serious?
He looks like he's between...
He looks like there's nothing but muscle on him.
Yeah, that's not healthy. Anyway,
it was healthy for Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Let's talk about the movies this week. So what's coming out this week? Filmworker is being released this week.
What?
Which was released, screened at ADIF. This is the documentary about the
movie. I did not realize that was getting released.
Yeah. So I believe...
So that'll knock Infinity War off its
spot. Yeah, this is the movie that we've been talking about and alluding to all through the podcast that will finally topple the blockbuster Infinity War. This is a documentary taking a look at Leon Vitali, who was Stanley Kubrick's factotum in many ways, but described himself as a film worker on all the paperwork. And it's screened at ADIF. I quite liked it. Were you there?
I've seen it and I did like it as well. And I actually would make the argument that it's not just for film nerds. It's actually a very interesting story, regardless of being like, oh, Barry Lyndon, or ooh, The Shining. It's actually
pieces of trivia.
It's got
this really good story running through it about what it is to sacrifice yourself to not your vision, not to something that you want, but to somebody else's vision.
Yeah.
Sort of to lay your own ambitions aside and to work to make somebody else's dreams a reality.
I kind of compare it to, and it was one of my favorite films ever when it came out, Bill Cunningham, New York, if anyone's seen that.
I've not.
Follows this, the New York Times runs this particular section where this photographer would go around New York and take pictures of people that he thought were dressed well, and he would then pick 8 and put them in the New York Times without fail for literally about 60 years. And he became this absolute sort of like mystery man because everyone would want to be featured in this. But the actual photographer himself, he's such a sort of small and assuming guy. He wears like a French refuge collector's coat because he can keep all his like gear in it. And when the film picks up, he's like 90 years old. He's living in like a box in New York and he's just cycling around taking pictures and no one really knows who this is. There's a great moment actually in it where the French collectively decide to honor him as the like one of these citizens of the arts kind of thing. And he's trying to get in and the security guard is like, what are you, old man? Go away. And somebody comes through and says, no, he's one of the most important people in the world. Bring him through here. His vision and his art and all these. But as you sort of say, he's someone who dedicated his entire life to this one particular thing and everything else just sort of isn't as important. And it's fantastic. And I'd compare Filmworker to that. I'd recommend both of them for those kind of... You don't have to necessarily be into fashion to love Bill Cunningham, New York. And you don't have to be getting
into
all the like, film to get the Filmworker film.
Also opening is Citizen Lane, which is an 8-minute feature documentary.
Matthew Von Lawler's, isn't it?
Von Lawler. So it's basically obviously focused on Hugh Lane, who famously has a gallery. It's basically...
That is what the trailers seem to show.
That would be primarily what I would have known.
He's the Lane from Citizen Lane.
which is, again, the title, you know, whether or not the title is a little on the nose, but there's no Lane in Citizen Lane. So he was a hugely influential Irish figure, and so it becomes like a window through which they can look at early 20th century...
You might say a gallery.
Dublin. Yeah, he becomes a sort of a gallery for the city. I see what you did there. That is screening as well this week. Also out this week, there may be a slightly bigger film opening, perhaps one might say. And in fact, it may already have opened, which is Deadpool, which began its weekend on Tuesday. And I suspect that's...
That's an amazing weekend.
Well, that's a way of taking a run at Infinity War, basically. I suspect that's the... I suspect that...
A run which is like smacking to a wall.
Yeah, it is. Well, it begins because it allows you to build a cumulative total over those 5 days. And I mean, was it Spectre? Famously had the 8-day opening weekend.
Yes.
Through the clever accounting of like...
I just think it's just Josh Brolin hedging his betches.
Yeah, either way he's laughing all the way to the bank.
Like,
yeah.
He's just like, I'm in this film, I'm in that film. Do you want to see real Brolin or fake Brolin? Choose.
And for everyone else, there's Sicario.
I still haven't seen that. I'm so annoyed.
There's a sequel.
No, I haven't watched the trailer, so I don't know anything, so...
I feel like the trailer won't give away that much about the original film. I feel like it's not a densely plotted sort of like continuity-driven film. And there's also no Emily Blunt in this one, unfortunately.
And it's not Denis Villeneuve or anything, is it?
No, it's not. I believe the writer was there. What's his name?
Is he the one that did Wind River?
Tyler Sheridan?
Oh, yeah.
Who did, Wind River.
What a film.
He directed Wind River, he wrote that. Mm. And he also wrote Hell or High Water as well.
Yes. Oh, yeah. He also did the third one, didn't he?
I really liked that.
Well, that was the third one. So the third one is, his Frontier trilogy is Sicario, Hell or High Water,
and then
Wind
River.
And
then
Sicario Wind
River.
2.
And
well, Sicario 2 has a name, doesn't it? It has an ellipsis.
Like some Den of Thieves or something. Yeah.
Den of Thieves. Don't say
Sicario
that.
Sicario 2.
Don't say that. You know what that film is. That's Jared Butler.
It is Day of the Soldado. And I apologize for mangling that. It's directed by Stefano Solima. Catherine Keener's in it. Which fills me with some sort of like warm feeling inside.
And just so I know... This is the week of May 25th when Solo's coming out?
Solo's coming out the 25th, but this is the weekend of the 17th. So this is Deadpool.
Deadpool's week.
Like in terms of box office, yeah. So this is the one.
This is where we are now.
Infinity War got an extra week because it got pushed a week ahead. Deadpool is kind of the first blockbuster to take a running start at it. And like it's telling that it needed 6 days to do that. I liked it. I actually quite liked
Deadpool.
Neither
have I. But
I'm excited to see it. I'm excited to see how they pull off Cable. How is Brolin in... How like... Because I love Brolin.
Is he Brolin with the punches?
That's five.
That's fine. And I just... Because I like Brolin. I remember my first time seeing Brolin in the film. It was The Goonies. So it's interesting now to see him in this role, and it'll be interesting to see what he's like, because I love him as Thanos.
Yeah.
And I'll be interested to see what he's like as Cable, because Cable is a kind of a cult favourite of mine. I always thought he was the weird mutant in the X-Men cartoons, you know, when he just would randomly show up. I'll be interested to see how they pull him off.
He's famously older than his father.
Yes. Though he was raised by his father.
Because comic books work that way.
But he was raised by his father. And then he has an evil twin.
He's,
and a younger self.
Yeah, he came from the time in the 90s when the X-Men comics were like, we are so wealthy that we are all doing so much cocaine. we'll just roll with
it. We're just gonna have it that he's raised by his parents in the future and then sent back to his parents when they are like in their early 20s. And he's now in his 40s?
Also, he's possibly the Terminator. You can tell that there was a lot of influences there and a lot of kind of not a lot of necessarily linear thought put into how this is going to work. But Deadpool 2 actually works remarkably well because it's got that very straightforward approach. Like the thing with the Deadpool and Deadpool 2, both of them, is that people tend to treat them as if they're comedies or deconstructive parodies, which they're not really. In that they don't tend to pick at or criticize superheroes. If you want a superhero deconstruction, you're best looking for something like Defender with Woody Harrelson, for example. Or even Mystery Men, which is fantastic and horribly underrated.
What was the one
90s.
By James Gunn with...
Dwight
from The Office.
Yes.
And
Ellen Page.
Yeah.
And what's his
she
face?
She was playing Bolty.
Yes. Nathan Fillion as like Jesus superhero. Yeah. Can't
Kevin
remember.
Bacon as the villain.
Yes.
Hero. Super.
Super. That's
super.
Was super
yeah.
Which
super.
Is fantastic.
Yeah.
I clearly remember the use of the wrench in that.
Yeah.
And
it's
that's what he's called.
Shut up, crime.
Yeah. That's what he's called, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. The wrench.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because it's technically he's walking up to somebody and doing them with a wrench. Deadpool is not a deconstruction of these side of movies. It's a very clear example of these kind of movies.
Mm.
But because it's structured in the way that it is, it has a very simple, very linear story. And it's kind of almost refreshing after Infinity War is like, watch us juggle this 10 gajillion things going on. That Deadpool 2 is just a fairly bog-standard superhero movie which executes its story beats relatively well. It's very clean, it's very well told, it hits every single beat that you would expect it to hit. It does so in a way that it uses irony and humor in a way to deflect from an earnestness underneath.
So is it safer than the first one was?
The first one was very safe. Like, I mean, it was an R-rated superhero movie, but it was still... Nobody was... like, okay, very few people should have been going to Deadpool and going, this is radical and transcendent.
No.
It's a good
one. It was
well-made.
Fun, yeah.
Like, I mean, one of the points that I've made is that... Or the points I've seen made is that, like, Deadpool is a really good Valentine's Day movie because it was released famously around Valentine's Day 2 years ago.
Also, I would say Deadpool allowed audiences and studios to accept R-rated superhero films in the modern age, which gave us Logan.
It did, but again, you're talking about it coming off the back of stuff like Defender and Super in the independent realm.
But there's a difference between independent and original IPs like those than going into an established...
Oh, there is some doubt.
Like, I know everyone goes that they're the R-rated, but like, you know, there's obviously Blade, Spawn, they were R-rated. But I'm talking about the more modern age type.
No, I mean, it did do something. It's just, it's not radical in the way that a lot of people seem to talk about.
Yeah, and I think it's because it's...
a little cheeky.
It's a little cheeky, and it's a little cheeky from a stable of films that aren't actually that cheeky.
Yeah.
And
maybe they should be.
Exactly, and I think it's perfect that it's sort of... maybe it's the IP lawyer in me, but seeing the way it sits kind of in the Marvel Universe, kind of in the X-Men Universe, but it's also its own thing. I think that suits it perfectly, and it's got that whole winky kind of...
Yeah, one of my favourite low-key aspects of the first movie was the idea that it somehow managed to unfold on like an abandoned S.H.I.E.L.D. helicarrier from the movie franchise that we can't name.
Yeah.
They very famously, and this spoils absolutely nothing because this scene didn't make the movie, but in early planning they were trying to get Chris Evans back as one of the heroes who would audition for X-Force, because you've seen it in the trailers.
Yeah.
But the big reveal would be that he was auditioning as the Human Torch from the Fantastic Four movies, which Fox owned the rights to.
Chris! And you know Chris Evans would have loved that.
But yeah, that was there's that sort of playfulness to it, which I kind of...
I would have loved that.
Yeah.
I would have adored that.
Personally, the trailer made me like actually laugh, and the reveal of the Rob Delaney character skydiving, that actually made me like burst out laughing when I saw it.
He is a breakout character. Pete is like one of my favorite characters of the year so far.
Fantastic. That's all I'm so...
He's not the dude with the mustache, is he?
Yes.
Okay, alright. I did wonder, because I was like, he doesn't look like anyone I know.
That's the whole point.
That's the point.
The whole point is that you have these gigantic crossovers that involve...
Like Terry Crews!
That involve everybody, and it's just like, you have this guy who showed up with a mustache because he saw the ad. And it's like, yeah, you can be in this adventure too, because everybody else is... It's really, really good. It's funny. It's not gut-brustingly hilarious, apart from one joke, which is one of the best jokes I think I've seen in a superhero movie.
Great.
But it's well told. It's clearly structured, and it knows what it's doing, and it has a very earnest emotional core, which I think works really well.
What do you want?
But anyway, so that's enough from this week. But guys, if you are trying to find a little bit of Alex or Graham on the internet, where can we do so?
You can find me at scanon.com. I've done a few reviews for them over the last couple of days alone. I'm on Game Air, which is also a part of Scanon, which I review and report on gaming news. And I'm at Graham Geek Era on Twitter.
Perfect.
So that's me.
Nice.
The main thing I want to plug is my podcast, which I promise I will update soon.
When you have a podcast, you're always like, I'll do it.
I will get to it.
I feel like we're contributing to productivity by just drawing you in an hour-long conversation about films.
No, it's called When Irish Eyes Are Watching, and we look and watch at Irish films and kind of discuss them and the context and their accents and all that kind of thing. We can be found on Twitter, but mostly you can just Google When Irish Eyes Are Watching.
Perfect. You can find me at Darren Harvest for Money. I co-host the podcast 250. This week we'll be talking about Tangerines, the first Estonian film to be nominated for the Best Foreign Film Oscar, and the first Estonian film to make the top 250.
Where is it, Darren?
What?
Where is it?
It's no longer in there. So we'll be talking about that on the 250 this weekend. You can find us by Googling or at the 250 online. But until then, take it easy, guys. We'll be back next week. Bye.
Thanks.
Bye.